Blog Talk Radio.
When Jean Lafitte left Barbary Island, they fled for their lives. From Florida to Galveston Island, many took Indian wives. From a mixture of many nationalities, a new race was born. With high cheekbones and an olive complexion, they're called red bones. I'm a red bone. I'm a Lungeon, if you please. My ancestors were the Natchez, Choctaw, and the Cherokee. Yes, I'm a red bone, and I'm proud I'm one. All of us red bones are real native sons. Black, white, red, and yellow are real potpourri. Doctors, lawyers, heads of state, many have come to be. We've always answered our country's call to defend our great land. Many have died on the battlefield with a weapon in their hand. Yes, I'm a red bone. I'm a Lungeon, if you please. My ancestors were the Caddo, the Seminole, and the Creek. Yes, I'm a red bone, and I'm proud I'm one. All of us red bones are real native sons. Some may look down their nose at a people so proud. Our bright flashy dress stands out in any crowd. With a trace of blood in their own veins, they scoff and poke fun. But nine times out of ten, their son or their daughter will marry one. Yes, I'm a red bone. I'm a Lungeon, if you please. My ancestors were Alabama, Cashada, Atakapa, Connie. Yes, I'm a red bone, and I'm proud I'm one. All of us red bones are real native sons. Yes, I'm a red bone. I'm a Lungeon, if you please. My ancestors were the Caracon, Kamuka, Apalachee. Yes, I'm a red bone, and I'm proud I'm one. All of us red bones are real native sons. Yeah, and some were hog thieves, moonshiners, women chasers, potheads, draft dodgers. Why, they qualify to be president.
Well, that was our opening song, and I have never played that song before. That was a song written and performed by Herschel, a local Redbone in Calcasieu Parish, and he donated that song to us, and I thought he actually did a really good job, and he mentioned the Melungeons, so I thought it was pertinent to mention it today. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. My name is Stacey Webb, and I am your host from backintime.biz. And I'm here today with one of my most favorite, well, my favorite cousin, April Mullins Mila. And I met her in 2006. She's an extraordinary Melungeon. She is has been to Turkey numerous times, was heavily involved with Dr. Brent Kennedy and all of those who were the founding members of the Melungeon Heritage Association, who does have their gathering union this next week, June 20th, 21st, and 22nd. Now, on the 20th, I believe they're going to be at Vardy Community, and then 21st they're going to be in Morristown, Tennessee. which is not that far for me. It's about 4.5 or 5 hours from here. So I'm going to go out, and I'm going to be there on Friday and Saturday, and I'll have some books for sale. And they always have the most extraordinary presenters, and this year promises to be just as wonderful as all the rest. And we hope that you can join us out there. But without further ado, let me introduce April. And April, tell us all about your Melungeness.
Well, where do I begin to tell this story? I always tell people, if they say, what's a Melungeon? I say, you got 2 hours, because it takes about that to be able to even touch the surface of what it's all about.
I agree. Well,
and we talk in the middle of the night for hours about connections, so probably better if we just go with specific questions, you know?
Exactly. I think that the first time that I met you, you did a presentation on grave houses, which Don Marler featured a grave house from there in Texas. I believe it's in Texas, the one that's pictured on the front of Red Bones of Louisiana, which is a book that is no longer available, but we hope to, backintime.biz and Mira Publishing, I do have the publishing rights on that book, so I'm hoping soon, you know, that we will get that redone, and it's a matter of old style being converted to new style, so that's been the holdup. But you did a presentation in 2006 in Kingsport, Tennessee, which just fascinated me, the research you had done on these grave houses and the historical value and the clues to our mixed ethnic, you know, our people. And so please do tell me the history and what you know of these clues that might help us in the future to better identify some of our ancestors.
Okay, well, Brent Kennedy very much wanted me to collaborate with Don. And I tried to, and he wasn't giving it up. I don't know if he thought I was going to steal his stuff or what, but Brent knew what I was on to, and he very much wanted us to collaborate. But Brent was so open to everybody coming together and having a multidisciplinary approach to this mystery, if you will, and he was right on target with everything. So I guess what I should tell you is, for me, I had been to college before, and I had been a social worker for many, many years, and I got bit by the Melungeon fever when I went to Turkey. The first time I went over there, it was a situation where I was supposed to go with my dear friend Garland, and she always wanted to go to Turkey. I had no desire. All I knew about it was Midnight Express. And I had always wanted to go to the Greek Isles, and so this was a cruise, everything included, and you flew into Istanbul or flew into Athens, and then you could ferry the Greek Isles, which included the Turkish coast, or we often refer to it as the turquoise coast over there. So I did that right before I was to depart. It was in 1997. She fell at work. She was a bench chemist, and she hurt her knee. And she didn't have any. When we paid for the trip, she didn't get any travel insurance or anything because she was in good health. So she said, you know, everything's paid for, you just need to go on. And I said, what? And, of course, I was terrified, absolutely terrified, but I did it. And it literally changed my life. It changed my entire life.
Wow.
So with the departure, I went up. I had friends from Marshall University, where I went to school the first time, a Jew who lived out on Long Island. And so he let me stay there with him, but he had to go to work that day. So I was in East Northport, I think, or one of those little towns. It was an old whaling community, and I was just kind of, you know, knocking around. And I went into this one shop, and there was a very interesting to me this little postcard, but it had all these different totem animals on it. I mean, certainly not all from the various tribes, but I just put that in my purse, you know, bought it, of course, put it in my purse, and so I had it with me, just serendipitously I had it, you know. So then when I flew out of New York, on the plane, Princess Diana died. So here I am, plane, with all these Arabs and Turks, and this is going on, which was quite interesting to say the least. And then while I was in Turkey, because I did the Istanbul, arrived in Istanbul, the night that I saw the whirling dervishes, Mother Teresa passed. So I'm like, okay, God, something's going on here. You know, I try and pay attention to the Lord, and I am a strong believer. And so then things unraveled and unveiled in very interesting and marvelous ways. I ended up in Istanbul, which, like I said, saw the whirling dervishes, did the Hagia Sophia, you know, that kind of touristy stuff. This is my first trip. I went back and forth like 8 times and ended up eventually living over there. But so anyway, I went to one, all tourists go to these, you know, rug shows where, you know, just the fact that they put them out there and they do all these wonderful things when they lay them out, and it's just a show in itself. And they had a prayer rug. And I looked at that prayer rug, and I was kind of interested in it, but, you know, it didn't do anything great for me. So then I boarded the cruise ship, and at that time I wasn't that familiar with my itinerary, really. I didn't even know I was going to be back in Turkey again. But I was, in fact, and it was in the small community of Kushadasi, which Kushadasi is, I would say to people, kind of like the Myrtle Beach, if you will. I mean, if you had to compare the two, of the Turquoise Coast. Now, the elite area there would probably be Bodrum and Antalya, and that would be like maybe the Outer Banks or something of that nature here. So when I got off the ship, I was supposed to be on one bus. I was getting on one bus and almost got on the wrong bus, and this lady said, oh, no, you're to be on my bus. And her name was Nuran Sule, who ended up becoming my wonderful, wonderful friend for many years and still is, and she's still over there. And the other trips that I would take back and forth, I would often stay with her as well. And I just developed a complete and extended Turkish family over there. Nuran, I used to call her the Countess of Kushadasi. Beautiful, beautiful Turkish woman, both inside and out. So then we went to, the first place we went to was Ephesus, and on the way we stopped at this place where they sold, you know, the various Turkish scarves and things like that, and I was late getting back on the bus, and other people were just like nasty, nasty, nasty to me. And I just said very softly, I'm so sorry, please forgive me. And that made an impact on her because she said, you know, I have people that give me Bibles all the time. She said, but you demonstrated something different as a Christian that I'd never seen before. So then we ended up going to Kushadasi, back to where the boat had actually landed or came to port, and we went into this carpet shop called, changed names a couple of times, Lapis, and that's where I bought my prayer rug, and it's a silk-on-silk prayer rug, and it has the animal that was in that card that I had. And the man who
ethnic to their, is that something ethnic to their culture as well? Totems.
This is very unusual.
Totems.
this is very unusual, you see, because Turkish rugs, you're talking about the Islamic culture, they cannot, and it's against their religion to depict anything that is alive in material things.
Yes.
They do a lot of designs and stuff in their rugs. But this was a silk-on-silk prayer rug, and I had to have it. He was not the person who showed me the rug. It was a guy named Typhoon, believe it or not. And we were trying to negotiate the price on it. And I said, remove your shoes. You're on holy ground. He took his shoes off and sat down, and the price fell by $1,000. So then Faridun comes in, who is the one who ended up being my beautiful, beautiful friend, and we still speak and talk on a regular basis. And this was in the rug room, and he sat across the room from me, and I sat, you know what I mean, like it's like a bench all the way around the room. It's like almost a round room. And he said to me, he said, may I ask you a personal question? I said, certainly. And he said, what is that perfume that you're wearing? And I said, oh, that's opium. He had never smelled it before, which I ended up finding out later, years later, is because I had dogs all over me on the Isle of Mytilene or Lesbos. They don't wear it because that smells like the drug, you know, for goodness sake.
Right.
Then the next thing that happened was we negotiated the price. I got a really, really great price. And when I'm doing my credit card, he sees the name April Mullins Mila. And he was the person who identified me as being Melungeon. He said, oh, are you Melungeon? And I said, why do you say that? He said, I know about these Melungeon, Dr. Brent Kennedy. And I said, well, not that I know of, because at that time, 97, I'd been told, you know, oh, no. You know, our line goes back to Irish Mullins and stuff. So that was the beginning. So I come back to the States, and when I get back to the States, I keep wondering when this rug's going to arrive, you know? And it arrives, Stacy, on the day of that harmonic conversion or whatever, when all the planets lined up. That's the day that arrived on my doorstep. And I said, oh, you know, something else.
Right. So did you come back home and get in touch with Dr. Kennedy and your find out about your millennium? I know you have not had your genealogy done, which is very curious to me because I'm a genealogist. I would just die to know, but you have had your DNA done.
There was a great reason for that, though, Stacy, because once I got in touch with Brent and I knew that this is absolutely what I wanted to spend my life doing, I didn't want to skew my research. And so if I would have, at that point, tried to jump into genealogical research, it would have skewed my results. You know, you find what you're looking for, you know what I mean? And I wanted to be objective about it. I really wanted to be objective. So I ended up going to college. I ended up going to Randolph-Macon Women's College. I thought, well, you know, if I've got to get a ticket, I might as well get a first-class ticket. I ended up getting scholarships, and I ended up doing summer research on Melungeon, and I got a Jesse Ball DuPont research grant that summer. So my research spanned two continents. And the field work here included going to powwow down with the Saponi. And I had some interesting events happen there with the Saponi. Lawrence Dunmore at the time was the chief, and they were resurrecting their language. And I said, what does the word Mika mean? And
say it again.
He said it means raccoon. Now, if I were a native, you know, and I wanted to describe these people, what looks more like everything mixed up in the world but a raccoon, right?
Right.
But he kind of kept his distance because he kind of knew what Melungeons were about, and, you know, they were on the path of being recognized. So, but anyway, I still gleaned a lot of very pertinent information from going to that powwow.
Right,
also gone to some of the powwows. You know, I'm not that far from Bear Mountain and the Monacans. Okay, so I've gone to several of their powwows as well.
Right.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, tell me about how you got interested in the grave houses.
Oh my goodness. Well, the first thing I did to kind of direct me in terms of where am I going with this is I went to the primary work. And so the primary work was with a cultural geographer, Price, Edward Price. And I was actually able, and you'd love that. I have a copy of that. I know you're going to want it. And he pretty much poo-pooed it, you know. He said, well, you know, there is one thing that we know is that they had this practice of doing grave houses, but it doesn't mean anything. And I thought, he's a cultural geographer. He was not an anthropologist. And when I went back to school, I went back to school, and my degree was in anthropology, sociology, and then with a concentration with
Ottoman Empire.
Yeah, I was going to tell you that, too, with our concentration in history, because I wanted to, and human services, and I graduated with honors in my field, I might add. So I knew what I needed to know, that I needed to know as much as I could about that veiled period of American history, the 1500s, which we know so very little about. And then also I knew that Ottoman period historically that I had to know about that. So all my history classes were of that period. And so from there I kept looking and looking and looking. And, I mean, I looked at literally everything that talked about burial practices that you could look at, that you could find. And the only place at that time, this would have been in 1999, that had any kind of coursework on necroethnicity was Harvard. They had one course on it, and that was it. I did find the works of Donald Ball, who had published about the Middle Tennessee grave houses, and he had decided that there was nothing really that special about them, but that they were probably influenced by the English Lychgate or the Scottish Cairn. But he was wrong. I mean, sorry, Donald. I mean, I talked to him, told him, I said, I'm sorry, but I respect your work, but you're wrong. so everything that I found out about the grave houses showed me that, indeed, this was an amalgamation of this offshore other, whoever they might have been, with Native American women. Because I knew, and I kept saying, they have to come from a Native womb. And there's no other way. You got a Native womb. And so you look
Melanie,
at the
you've got pictures of grave houses in at the Native American and Cherokee graveyard. Taken in 1970.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. Can you repeat that?
Yes, you have in your presentation, you presented us with a Cherokee graveyard in Stillwater, Oklahoma, where originally there was grave houses. So,
yes, because the other archival information that you'll see there came from Hollybush, from the archives there in Kentucky.
Yes.
Okay. And so those photos of Stillwater, Oklahoma, show that they brought that practice with them, you know, once they were removed. You know, I mean, people are
yes.
not going to give up their burial patterns. And even through being conquered, they just don't give it up. This is something that's innate and will continue culturally on and on and on and on. But my proposition was, of course, and then I also indicated that more research was certainly needed, was that my proposal was that it had an Ottoman admixture. And the way that I found that out was I went back to Turkey during my research. I went back there, and I'm in Ephesus. And so I have a picture of that one 1850-some. I don't know if you have a picture of that one or not. That was pretty intact. And the fence posting there, Stacy, it looked to me like a picket fence, okay? But I had a picture of that because that was the most preserved, okay, that I had of this material culture, okay? And
right.
she's looking at that, and she said, this is Ottoman in design, the archaeologist at Ephesus, okay, at the museum. And
wow.
I said, no, that's a fence. She said, you don't understand. She said, I studied in Washington, D.C. I lived in America. Yes, I'm Turkish. I'm telling you, this is Ottoman in design. And then she told me that the tombstones of that period looked like that picket, that what I thought was a picket fence. So then I, again, because of my great relationship with Feridun Usturun and his family, they took me to a cemetery in Turkey that period, and that's what you're seeing there. Or you might just see an image, but I actually have photographs of those tombstones in Turkey. And guess what? That's exactly what it was. So this is the amalgamation. This suggests that there's definitely a Turkish admixture here. Now, I will not say, as many, many did, you know, well, they're not just Turkey. You know, Brent Kennedy, they gave him money and they wanted to jump on the Melungeon bandwagon and be associated with Americans. And, you know, well, they were the only ones that opened their doors to Brent. Okay, other scholars slammed the doors in his face, thought he was crazy, okay? I say
sure.
there are many. I mean, I'm going to give credit to the Spanish researcher and Manuel Mira, the Portuguese researcher. You know, we are many, all people, you know, one people, all colors. So you have admixtures of Spanish, you have admixtures of Portuguese, you have admixtures of Turkish, Ottoman. You know, the Ottoman Empire was vast, very vast.
Absolutely.
You know? So that's when I the Nef, it's Melungeon Nef. Melungeon's just got the press, but you have all these groups up and down the Appalachian, the Indian trade routes. And I think you found a map from that presentation that shows those different, they call them triracial isolates. They were not isolated. They were, you know, on the interstate at that time, which was
okay.
The...
Okay. Let's break. Just let me make a quick announcement. We are... it looks like we're going to lose live stream, but it will still be recorded, and we will pick up and talk about the Appalachian Highway of Trade there that you're discussing now, and you provided a map, which was an excellent map. I'm going to scan all of this material because I want to pick up. Our listeners can, as soon as the show is over, it will take about an hour, and then this will be available. The rest of the interview will be available. Okay, go ahead, April. Let's go right back where you were at.
I don't remember where I was.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Well, I'll fill you in because I was keeping up.
You had just begun to start talking about the Grave House influence on the Appalachian, and that you were talking about the map you had presented with
Okay. Well, now let me tell you, the happiest moment in a researcher's life is when they find an out-of-print book that they've been searching for.
Right, a rare manuscript. Right.
Hey, you know who I'm talking about, right? Do you know who I'm talking about?
One lonely sociologist
wrote a book about all these mixed people groups. He went and interviewed them. Almost white.
Yes.
And I got it. And guess where it
was? Oh, my
goodness. It was at Randolph-Macon Woman's College on the shelf. Can you believe
my
it? Under my nose the whole time. I was ecstatic.
You have got to get me coffee. I don't know what the copyrights are on Almost White. If we can, you know, what do you have, a physical copy of it, or do you have a copy of it?
Look, have the book, because before I graduated, I checked it out and I couldn't find it. I couldn't find it anywhere, and I had to pay full price for that book, or I wasn't going to graduate. And then after I graduated, months and months later, I found it. So it's my book. I mean, I paid like $135 for that book. It's a lot of money when you're struggling in college. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
So I have it. But anyway, I digress. Okay, the other thing I wanted to say is during this, I'm real good about taking care of my teeth. Okay, so I'm going to my dentist, and he's like, well, what are you doing now? Because I've had so many different interests in my life. He goes, well, what are you doing now? And I told him a little bit about the melanoma and stuff. He goes, let me see if you have the turbicle of Caraballi. And I'm like, what? And obviously he must have really studied when he was in dental school. And I said, what's that? And I have it in all my molars. What it is, it is an ethnic marker for persons around the Mediterranean.
I see.
And you're not going to have it in your body unless somebody came from around the Mediterranean.
Right. Isn't that interesting?
So that was a physical affirmation for me that, yeah, I am this. And when I started talking to my relatives, now that was really interesting, because I had always heard that my grandmother, well, I remember my grandmother, it was my grandfather that was the Mullins, but I remember my grandmother, they said, oh, yeah, she's Indian, Cherokee. Of course, they always said Cherokee. And she chewed tobacco. And, I mean, I'm like 8 years old, and here she is, you know, bedridden and had broken her hip, and she's chewing tobacco and spitting, and I'm mortified, you know. I don't know what to think. And so then when I started doing this research, I started talking to my dad's sisters. There were 14 children in that family. I sent you that picture. I don't know if you got it or not. But many were still alive. As a matter of fact, my Aunt Rosa is still alive, and she'll be 99 on the 4th of July. George Washington Mullins married America Hagerman, and my Aunt Rosa was born on the 4th of July.
Wow.
She'll be 99
that is...
on the 4th of July. Yes, indeed. But I started asking my Aunt Luema about Grandma and my other aunts that were still alive at the time. And my Aunt Luema told me that Grandma used to read Coffee Grounds.
Wow.
That they do all over the Mediterranean, they'll read your cups. And reading people's cups, you know, I picked it up like nothing, you know.
I
can read your cup, but
really
you never read a cup. up after the sun goes down. That's bad juju.
bad juju. I always know, of course, I lived in the Middle East growing up whenever I was a girl, and I also was married to a Jordanian-born Palestinian. And I go and rinse my cup very quickly around certain people anyway. You know, it's a tradition thing. You know,
they'll like read your plate too. I can do the cup and the plate.
Yeah,
have you seen them do the plate?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that might be another discussion. Okay, so what else do we want to make sure that we... Oh, Darlene Wilson. Now, we got to give kudos to Darlene Wilson. Darlene
Absolutely.
Wilson. Well, I could only dream of being able to write like Darlene Wilson. She is the best writer I know.
She is
and
a fabulous
when they were,
writer.
I mean, when the academics were, you know, trying to crucify Brent, because he did not write his book as an academic work, okay, number one. And when they were all going after him, it was Darlene Wilson who defended him among those groups.
Yeah.
Because he's her cousin.
Yeah.
They're cousins, for one thing. I mean, literally cousins, not, you know, we and the... In the Melungeness call each other cousins, but I mean they're literally cousins. And
absolutely,
enough good stuff about Darlene the major contributions that she's made to this, and she was on the board, and she and I both left when they started that genome project. That's when we dropped out.
I see.
Yeah, there was a lot of people that dropped out.
You were not real fans on DNA.
No, not at all. Because, you know, the whole thing about Melungeons and Red Bones and Monica's and the list goes on and on is that we suffered. We were treated as badly as any people group. There was an ethnic cleansing of our people group. We can't forget to mention Plecker. And both Darlene and I and others felt like
we were
going to like a lot of things going on. All of a sudden, I'm a luncheon. You know, I mean, it's like we became proud of having this heritage. And we both felt that the DNA would almost create that white supremacy if people started getting into that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I understand. I understand.
That was their fear, yeah.
And I think the Native Americans as well, you know, came forward and said, and this is what they're struggling with, a lot of them now, especially mixed-blood Native Americans, because, you know, it creates some identity issues. You spoke earlier about, you know, some of the tribal members and their families retained their Native American ties to their local areas or what have you, and they're struggling with accepting their... the white man to tell them one more time where did they come from. But DNA is, that's what it's all about. It is a study of migration. And if we look at these mixed blood groups, like you've got this map, and it's basically a map that I had worked from years ago. And I don't know if maybe I worked from it because you gave me a copy. I can't remember. But you've got, you know, from Nova Scotia all the way into, you know, the very tip of South America, you just have scattered groups of these mixed bloods, you know, and of course, as soon as the settlers arrived and the colonists arrived, you know, they were pushed out. In fact, Tom Kingery has recently discovered a document or a list of men who were removed from Jamestown for marrying among the Native American women. And so
right.
those men, it, yeah, you know, they were immediately unwanted elements. And so we were forced into, yeah.
Ostracized.
Of course, there was, go ahead.
Ostracized and eliminated.
Yes.
Ostracized at best.
You talked about ethno-washing the other night.
No,
you
that's
just giggled
you.
And laughed.
You're the
yeah,
ethno-wash.
That's
you're the
you.
One that came up with that phrase. I credit
that's
you for that.
Right.
And the map that you're talking about is one that I had discovered post the Appalachian Studies Conference presentation and post the Melungeon Heritage Association. That's my current research. And I shared it with you
right.
as I do everything that can help us as we collaborate together, Stacy.
Absolutely, absolutely. And just like the Turkish map that one of the chair laws pointed out to me and provided to me, I sent you a copy, and it's a terrible copy, but there is a website that explains its origins, and it's 1803, where obviously the Turkish sent an expedition up the Mississippi River, and they, you know, named all of these tribes that some of them, we've had one lady from the DNA study group, she did translate part of, and she said, I've never heard of that Indian tribe. They're probably extinct now. So the recording of that map could have been even more ancient than 1803 was when it was published. And you know, this was in Turkish.
It would not have been in Turkish in the 1800s.
No. It was
because
it's written in Turkish. It's not in Arabic. We tried to have some Arab translators, and they said it's not Arabic. They thought it was Farsi, but it's not. It's Turkish.
Well, we can talk about that another time. I know what that was.
Right.
Yeah, and we can talk about that another time. But, you know, for me, that's why I shared that information on that global group that I was trying to get. I found out from my Turkish friends and from the research that I've done, this is Ottoman naval forces. The Ottomans were second only to the Spanish on the sea, okay? And
yes.
So know for a fact from what I have researched that I can see in English that they had pirates, and they were based off the coast of England, okay, during this time period.
Right.
Okay? So what I've been trying to do, and
sure.
there's a I can't quote his name right now, but there is one Turkish researcher that's his bailiwick, okay? And what I've been trying to find out is how many people could be on those boats of that time period. That is key to me.
Right.
How many Ottoman, not Turks, because, you see, the Ottoman world comprised so many various people. You had Greeks. You had Turks. You had, I mean.
Moors.
Yeah,
Rocky.
Absolutely. So I want to know that.
Yeah.
I want to know at that period what they were sailing in. What was the complement?
Right. The numbers of the ship, you know, their capacity and where they went. And, you know, we look at these we've got some interacting maps of the Spanish and Portuguese and English ships that, you know, came. And I don't believe that they even mention a Ottoman ship
Well, that's because this is obscure, very obscure Ottoman history.
Great.
Because I've been, because of, you know, the World Wide Web, I'm able to, that's how I came to find out about it, okay? I've got my notes over here,
yeah.
But they absolutely We're in the Atlantic.
Yeah, oh, sure.
The 1500s. They were in the Atlantic.
When I was going to college and finishing up, there was a huge